So this is the sixth day of the seventh day. Retreat on Fettering the Natural Mind here at Southern Dharma. And this will be the last sort of formal talk with a text and commentary tomorrow, or last time together in the Dharma talk. It'll be more focused on talking about post-retreat practice and really answering any questions you have about how to continue. Let me just say something about deep sharing. Again, as we have learned quite nonstop over these days, the narrative, the fictional narrative that we constantly maintain in our minds, self-fabricated, the endless stories we weave about who we are and who everybody else is and what is going on, this narrative has no life to it. So in our deep sharing, and we're learning here to share deeply, not the ordinary kind of sharing that we often do with each other. We just tell each other our stories. Today I did this, and last 10 years I did that, and, so what does that mean? It's again, the emphasis, it's not called sharing, is it? It's not called sharing and listening. It's called deep sharing, deep listening. Deep sharing means I am sharing something authentic, an authentic experience in me. How do I know it's authentic? Because there's some juice to it, right? There's some feeling with it. It can be a feeling of happiness, it can be feeling of sadness, it can be feelings of great openness, it can be feelings of great constriction, it can be feelings of frustration, anger, it can be feelings of great relief and openness when one has an insight or an understanding. But we know the authenticity because it is more than just a story. We are so used to telling each other our stories. And our stories really don't tell us who we are. It is in the present that we reveal to another human being who we really are. Is that clear? So when the instruction says, review the past 24 hours with all the things you've done, and see what pops out. It's really see what pops out as an authentic experience you had, where it wasn't just kind of going along, but something, like people said, something delightful, right? Or something the opposite. It doesn't matter. That's real. Real, I mean, it's real. It's a real experience. It's not just an experience from here up. See, don't tell me the story of what happened, tell me what it was like for you when it happened. Does that make it clear what we're talking about? Now, and again, this is something we're not used to. Why is it something we're not used to? Because why? Because we are what? Private people, right? And we love to what? Maintain our privacy at all costs. And so our authentic sharing with other human beings, even people we are close to, is often, as it says in the verses on the trust in mind, we pick and we choose, don't we? What we're going to present, what we're not going to present. That is the world of artifice, artificiality. In this tradition, what is prized is spontaneity. Spontaneity, not like, a free spirit spontaneity, which is often not free, but also just a kind of artifice. But a spontaneity that authentically emanates from you. in the Dzogchen tradition, like in the Zen tradition, openness, complete openness, is the stance. It is the stance of no stance. It is the stanceless stance. Because when you understand, and everybody here hopefully has had a little inkling, that there is nothing to protect. There's no self. There's nothing to protect. There's nothing to advance. There's nothing to hide. There's nothing to advance. Then you're free to what? To be you. Without picking and choosing, what to reveal or what not to reveal. Many people, they live in a defensive world that they have been in so long, they think it's natural. Right? It's like somebody who spent their whole life in a walled fortress and think it's normal to have big walls around to keep out. They couldn't imagine living in a house that had no walls and gates around it. So often our defenses seem so natural we don't even notice them. But often when somebody points them out to us, we immediately what? Justify, rationalize. There's a good reason why I have them. I have to protect. I don't want to be vulnerable. There's a little fragile being in there that is afraid. But as Andrew pointed out when he looked for his fragile, scared being, even though there were traces of those kinds of emotion impressions, he could not find anything. The whole structure was a joke, except it was more of a tragedy. Right? A joke because there was really nothing there. And a tragedy because all these years we have believed it is there and we've acted accordingly. There is nothing to protect, there is nothing to hide. As we see in this clear, open mirror of awareness, it just reflects. It has no agenda, it has no conditions. It is not concerned about what other people think of it. Right? I mean, does a mirror go, gee, I only want really good-looking things looking in me, No. Mirror reflects whatever appears before it. Please reflect on cultivating openness. One of the ways we cultivate openness in our meditation is when we sit down, we take a stance of total openness. Right? We do not pick and choose what arises, do we? Whatever arises, whether it's a wonderful thought, a terrible thought, no thoughts, endless thoughts, we're open to it all, aren't we? Our only job is what? Liberate whatever arises. How do we liberate it? We don't grasp, we don't push away, we don't label, we don't do anything. Just let it come and go. The vast expanse of emptiness, empty mind. Right? So it is in our sitting we learn how to be open. If you can learn to sit in complete openness, which means you're open to yourself, then it is much easier to be open to everything else. Yesterday, you mentioned, I heard in the sharing, that you had experience of spending several minutes just looking into another human being's eyes. I mean, I don't know what everybody's experiences were, but several people said it was quite moving and instructive. that when you finally could let go of all your ideas and all your sense of you're there and I'm here and who I am and you are and you know, all that nonsense, you saw a face that did not seem different than your own. You saw your own face looking at you. When you disappear, you become everything. You are everything. Then what are we protecting ourselves from? What are we hiding from? Is that clear? This is a way of openness, and therefore it is a path of fearlessness. We're not afraid to be what? To be authentic, to be real. As I was saying to somebody the other day, Pinocchio, poor Pinocchio, he didn't want to be a wooden boy, did he? He wanted to be real. Right? Many of us have become wooden in life. Something, a puppet is something that's made. Many of us have lost that original spontaneity and naturalness we had as young children. That kind of freedom, just to be who we are, without any shame or hesitation. That is why it is so refreshing for us to be around young children. But many of us have become artificial. Something fashioned. So we want to become real again. So please look for your whale. Today, just there may be some people who think that this original Buddha mind is only found in, you know, in Tibet. I was concerned about that. There must be something in the water or something. It's a high, you know, mysterious place, vast vistas. No wonder it's so easy for them, right? But those of us down here in the, you know, anyhow. So I'm going to share with you today an interesting, I don't know, I'll just skip around a little bit, we don't have a lot of time. His name was Bunke, and some of you have been around a while, heard me teach Zen Master Bunke. 1622 to 1693. An interesting guy, and also interesting because his actually teachings, his lineage died out. It was only kind of his writings. He actually very assiduously wouldn't write anything, and he forbid all his disciples to write anything down either. He didn't really want to leave a trace. But there was one, especially one nun, who very secretly, without his permission, would listen to his talks and write them down. And I think there was maybe one or two others. So because of that, there is a record. He didn't write anything, but there is a record of his talks. Zen Master Bunke. And again, his life is interesting. We can't spend any time, primarily because it so informed him. I mean, his father died when he was 10. He always had this great fear of death. They could say they could always shut him up if he was misbehaving or something just by mentioning death. He would immediately freeze. He was a very kind of headstrong kid, kind of a bad boy, very bright. Things that he liked to study, he'd study. Things that he didn't like to study, he wouldn't study. You know, so he got in lots of trouble at school. He would challenge his teachers. He had these. One of his great. He had this teacher in that day, they taught Confucianism, and there was this concept of bright virtue. And he would ask this Confucian teacher, his teacher, what is bright virtue? And the teacher would just give him words. Oh, it's the harmony of all things or something. And he wasn't satisfied, and he challenged the teacher. So anyway, he eventually got thrown out of school. And because he was such a, you know, he would go to class, he wouldn't go to class. In those days, it was unthinkable. His brother, his father had died. His brother, basically at 11 years old, threw him out of the house. You know, because he wasn't going to mount. So really at 11 years old, he was on his own. And he just had this incredible life where he would just wander about. He'd live in a shack. He would go to this temple, that temple, take this teaching, that teaching. He was looking for some kind of authentic experience. And he didn't have it. He was a great ascetic. I mean, he would take teachings, he would just practice. Eventually, he got himself, he nearly was dead. He contracted all kinds of diseases, he wouldn't eat. He walled himself up in little hermitages and wouldn't come out, and they just would pass him food. Anyhow, at the depth of that, he had two experiences. One is quite famous, where he was just filled with mucus and phlegm. Those of you who've been through this retreat may understand what that's about. But he passed us all by, and he was in this cave or this shack, and he just spit it out. And this big glob of mucus landed on the wall, and he just watched it. And all of a sudden, at that moment, everything fell away, and he was enlightened. All his strivings, all his stuff, all totally fell away, and he just saw things as they really were. It's also said some days later he had a similar type of experience. This time he had been meditating all night, and just in the morning, a fragrance of plum blossoms wafted into his, and just smelling them, again, he had another awakening experience. So afterwards, he did what many did in those days. He would seek out various of the Zen masters to confirm his experience, that he wasn't just gone crazy, that he'd actually had an experience, and to continue to practice. And he did finally find a Chinese Zen teacher who really trained him more and really confirmed his enlightenment. The interesting thing then, and he was early on given some kind of monastic responsibilities within the what's called the Rinzai, the Linchi lineage tradition, but he really went his own way. And even though he had practiced, as we know, hadn't gone through such difficulty for years and years and years and years, in his great enlightenment, or enlightenments, he came to realize how simple it all was. And that it's right before your very eyes. It's right before everybody's eyes. So he taught, he really turned his back on the traditions of his day. In Zen, it was, koans, I won't go into that, but the whole system of using the stories of the ancient Chinese masters to kind of be the focus of practice and study, or other types of ritual, even in his temples and monasteries. He didn't have a lot of schedules or rituals or anything like that. He really just taught the one Buddha mind and the spontaneity of living in it. Because of that, supposedly he was massively sought out. And when he would give these long 7, 10, 20, 30-day retreats, thousands of people would come to this little town where his temple was. Monks and nuns from all different Buddhist traditions, but also lots of lay people. Sort of like the old lady, you know. He was really loved by simple people, farmers, peasants, shopkeepers, because his teaching was so simple and direct. And he prided him, not prided, that's, forgive me, he didn't pride himself, but he said, yeah, I don't, you know, who teaches from those stories about the old masters? I want it to be alive. I teach directly whoever comes before me. So his teaching was very alive and present. Again, I think because it was so alive and present and et cetera, it died out. So he went a little too far because he didn't leave any kind of structure or anything. Probably, obviously, it was so dependent on him. He had such charisma, his great enlightenment and capacity. Over time, I understand his tradition was not able to maintain itself and eventually died out. He said, I was still a young man. Again, remember, he was thrown out of the house at 11. So his great enlightenment was in his 20s, mid-20s. So, I mean, you know. So he said, I was still a young man when I came to discover the principle of the unborn. That's what he always called it, the unborn. Right? Like this mind right now that is listening to me, if you look into it, you cannot see that it began somewhere, can you? No. This awareness, it has no place where it clicked on, did it? It's always there. It's always here. Therefore, it is unborn. It is not born from anything. That's beyond our ability to conceive. But it is something that we can experience. This thing has no beginning or end. It just is. It's only here. I came to discover the principle of the unborn and its relationship to thought. I began to tell others about it. What we call a quote-unquote thought is something that has already fallen one or two removes from the living reality of the unborn. Okay? So what's another word for the unborn? Direct, authentic experience. Spontaneous, unmediated by any kind of conception. As soon as we start thinking about an experience, we are what? Removed from it. The more we think, the more removed we become. You all understand that now, don't you? And obviously in this talk he was talking to priests. He says, if you priests would just live in the unborn, there wouldn't be anything for me to tell you about. And you wouldn't be here listening to me. But because of the unbornness and marvelous illuminative power inherent in the Buddha mind, it readily reflects all things that come along and transforms itself into them, thus turning the Buddha mind into thought. Right? I'm going to tell those in the lay audience all about this now. As I do, I want the priest to listen along too. So I made a mistake. There must have been, probably like in traditional Asian society, you know, the monks and nuns, because they're ordained, they sit one place, so he must have first addressed the monks. Now he said, I'm going to talk to the lay people. Because he's obviously dismissed them. I mean, obviously, you know, if you guys got it, you wouldn't be here, so. Right. But again, because this Buddha mind reflects everything, right? If we are not careful, when a thought arises, rather than just reflecting, and we grab onto it, then we start removing ourselves, right? So simply to have thoughts which are no other than the kind of energetic display of our mind, to watch them come and go, is fine, right? It's only when we grab on and get lost in them. So now he's addressing everybody. Not a single one of you people at this meeting is unenlightened. Right now you're all sitting, and please imagine that I'll just, I'll be an actor and pretend I'm Bunky. So not a single one of you sitting here in this meditation hall at Southern Dharma is unenlightened. Right now, you're all sitting before me as Buddhas. each of you receive the Buddha mind from your mothers when you were born, and nothing else. This is the great gift that was transmitted, the gift of awareness. All we've noticed up to now is that our parents transmitted to us our bodies, or they transmitted us certain characteristics, which we may be happy about or we may be unhappy about. But how many of us have noticed that the most essential thing that was transmitted to us upon our birth was awareness, this capacity to be aware and to know. This inherited Buddha mind is beyond any doubt unborn, with a marvelously bright, illuminative wisdom, just like in the Dzogchen text, right? It is this unborn awareness, and yet it has this illuminative quality that it lights up whatever it is aware of, and it has knowledge, and knowledge it has knowing. It is not dead. It is not inert. In the unborn, all things are perfectly resolved. Right? No questions, Harry. Right? All things are resolved. I can give you proof that they are now. Please listen. While you're facing me, if a crow cawed, right, or if a sparrow chirped, or some other sound occurred somewhere behind you, you would have no difficulty knowing that it was a caw of a crow, or a chirp of a sparrow, or just a call of a bird, or whatever, even without giving a thought to listening to it. Because you were listening by means of the unborn. Is that a fire truck? No. You didn't have to think. As soon as you heard it, even though you're listening to me and somewhere there's a sound, your unborn mind, don't make it into a thing, it just means this. Without even trying, knew, could hear and knew. And you didn't have to do anything, did you? Did you? While you face this way, listening to me now, if a sparrow chirps behind me, you don't mistake it for a crow, you don't mistake the sound of a bell for that of a drum, or hear a man's voice and take it for a woman's, or an adult's voice for a child's. You hear and distinguish these different sounds without making a single mistake, by virtue of the marvelous working of this illuminative wisdom. This is the proof that the Buddha mind is unborn and wonderfully illuminating. None of you could say that you heard the sounds because you'd made up your minds to hear them beforehand. Can't fool me, Fred. I was prepared for that question. No, you didn't have a clue. And yet your Buddha mind, your unborn mind, naturally knew what it is. You didn't have to do anything. All of you are looking this way or listening to me. You're concentrating single-mindedly on what I'm saying. There's no thought in any of your minds to hear the sounds or noises that occur behind you. The reason you can do that is because you're listening by means of the unborn Buddha mind. And it is marvelous, right? It can be aware of things inside. It can be aware of things outside. Right? It is not bound by anything, is it? Another one of his proofs. So you can see he didn't teach. His teaching was very direct and immediate. This is another one of his sermons. While you're walking down a road, if you encounter, and just imagine you're walking down a road, if you encounter a crowd of people approaching from the opposite direction, none of you gives a thought to avoiding the others, yet you don't run into one another. Everybody know, you know, like you're in a city or something and you're walking along and, you know, people are kind of moving this. And you're not thinking, I have to take three steps to my left. And then you just naturally do that, don't you? Same way with driving. There's a part of us that just is driving. What is this capacity that we have just to be aware and respond appropriately to things without having to think about it? You don't run into one another. You aren't pushed down or walked over. You thread your way through them by weaving this way and that, dodging and passing on, making no conscious decisions in this, and yet you're able to continue along unhampered nevertheless. Now, in the same way, the marvelous illumination of the unborn Buddha mind deals perfectly with every situation. Right? When Anthony tells us to chop the carrots like this and not like that, the unborn Buddha mind says what? Chop, chop, chop. Right? It is only our thinking, egocentric mind that goes, no. Nobody tells me what to do. Or what the hell is... what the hell is the difference between an eighth of a carrot and a fourth? Right, can you see? Right? That's this other mind, right? The Emperor Buddha mind doesn't care. You know, what do you want it? 4 feet long slices? Sure. Right? It just responds to things. Nothing's a big deal. Right. You want to be angry at me? That's fine. Right. You know. And when you're done, I'm curious about, you know, why you're angry at me. Or, you know, did I do something? You know, I didn't mean to. You know what I mean? It's like, what's the big deal? But we go, what? I can't believe it. They think I did this and then they did that. You know? Right? We leave our unborn Buddha mind that just reflects and naturally responds. Right? We leave it and we go where? Into the story of self. And next time you're in New York City and you're weaving in and out, try to think about it first. Right? You'd bump into somebody. Or they bump into you. You'd be standing there kind of, right? I mean, and just try to figure out, now, how do I get my left foot to like, take one, two, step, but, yeah, like that. Oh, and he says that, actually. Suppose that the idea to step aside and make way for the others should rise spontaneously in your mind before you actually moved aside. That, too, would be due to the working of the Buddha's mind, illuminative wisdom. You may step aside to the right, to the left, because you've made up your mind to do that, but still the movement of your feet one step after another doesn't occur because you think to do it. When you're walking along naturally, you're walking in the harmony of the unborn. If if I say, I am drinking tea, right? Before I could say that to you, there had to be a knowing, right? Before the words comes the knowing. But we don't trust the knowing. We only trust the words. That's why it is said, when can I meet somebody that I can talk to without using words? And he seems to like that talking, dog barking, crow cawing. He liked that one. Because no, like, well then, what does it mean you're endowed with the Buddha mind? Each of you present decided to come here from your home in the desire to hear what I have to say. Now if a dog barked beyond the temple walls while you're listening to me, you'd hear it and know it was a dog barking and not a crow. Must have been a lot of crows around there. While you're here, you hear all kinds of sounds. Your eyes see and distinguish reds and whites and other colors. Your nose can tell good smells from bad. You could have known no way of knowing beforehand which sights, sounds, or smells you might have encountered here, and yet you immediately recognize all of them as soon as you encounter them without any premeditation. That is because your actual seeing and hearing is occurring in the unborn. What are we preparing for? What are we rehearsing for? Why are we having expectations, anticipations? You know what I'm talking about? Why is that? Because we don't trust this unborn mind, that it will naturally and spontaneously be present to whatever happens and responds to whatever's happening, right? Which is what's going to happen anyhow. Because we do not trust this true mind in this capacity, we are left with trusting what? Our thoughts, our strategies. Our egoistic projections. That you see and hear and smell in this way without giving rise to the thought that you will is the proof that the inherent Buddha mind is unborn and possessed of a wonderful illuminative wisdom. When a dog howls, even if 10 million people said in chorus that it was the sound of a crow cawing, I doubt if any of you would be convinced. There's no way they could delude you into believing what you know not to be true. Again, that's because the knowing knows, right? When you know what tea is, and if I drank this and if it was coffee, I would know it. Even if everybody said to me, no, Fred, that is tea, that is tea you're drinking, I would know it because I know what coffee is. How do I know it? I know it from experience. Once you know things from experience, you cannot be fooled. Once you know the genuine from the artificial, you cannot be fooled. Once you know nutritious food from junk food, you cannot be fooled. Once you know what health is like, you know it is not the same as sickness. You cannot be fooled. Is that clear? You can only be fooled if you do not trust your own experience. Many people get wounded in life because they don't trust their own experience. Someone is being unkind to them, but that person might say, but I really care for you. And so their own experience of being met with unkindness is not authenticated, is it? When we live in our true mind and have authentic experiences, we know kindness from cruelty. Right? And we cannot be fooled. But if we do not know our own mind, we do not know our own direct experience, we can easily be fooled. We can settle for less. Each and every Buddha and Bodhisattva in the universe, and everyone in the world of human beings as well, has been endowed with a Buddha mind. But being ignorant of the fact that you have a Buddha mind, you live in illusion. Why is it that you're deluded? Because you're partial to yourself. Do you want me to read that again? Bhante was a simple man. What is this illusion that we live in, and the fact that we are ignorant of our true mind because we are partial to ourself? Which self is that? Myself. Right? Right? There are 7 billion selves running around this world, and we're partial to only one. Isn't that true? Yeah. We may dole out a little bit to a few others. But if we're really honest, right? So he gives an example. Let's take something close to home. So suppose you heard that your next door neighbor was whispering bad things about you. Trish raises her eye. How would you like that, Trish? I don't like it. Bhante must have known you. He said, you'd get angry. Yeah. Every time you saw his face, you'd immediately feel indignant. You'd think, oh, what an unreasonable, hateful person. Right? And everything that he said or did would appear in a bad light to you. This is all because you are wedded to yourself. By becoming angry, losing your temper, you just transform your Buddha mind into the existence of a demon. He goes on to say, are you listening, Trish? If your neighbor praised you instead, said something that pleased you, you'd immediately be delighted. And even if the praise was totally undeserved, and therefore the pleasure you felt totally unfounded, simply a product of your wishful thinking, you would still think what? What a wonderful guy he is. The delight you experience when this happens is due to that same obstinate constitutional preference to yourself. Again, if your neighbor, let's say your neighbor's here, you live here, and then you have a neighbor on the other side, right? Now, if he was going on saying, derogatory things about, you know, the person living on the other side, you might go, what? Yeah, this could be true, yeah. Yeah. Or or, you know, you might just listen and, you know, right? Go, let's, you know. But you wouldn't be indignant, would you? You wouldn't be angry. It's the same neighbor, you know, saying something. But the difference is what? He's not saying it about me. I mean, when he's saying it about somebody else, we might go, well, that may be true. You know, there could be something, let me think about that. Right? But when it's us, we're not willing to go, well, I wonder if that's true. But, you know, indignant. How dare he? Right? In the same way, you know, when we're praised and somebody thinks we're wonderful, even if we totally know it's untrue and unfounded, we still immediately think, even if we yesterday we were so angry at this guy, we might be thinking what? Gee, maybe I was wrong about him, you know? He really is a very perceptive human being. could see all my good qualities. Yeah, maybe I'll invite him over. What has changed? Is everybody clear? And we're like that, right? We pass somebody in the hall, you know, they're very friendly, we think, oh, the world is bright and shiny, isn't it? Next day we pass them in the hall, they don't even make eye contact with them, we think, oh, what's wrong with that person? What an idiot. You know, what did I do wrong? All of that arises why? Because we are partial to who? Ourselves. He says, stop and look back to the origins of this self of yours. When you were born, your parents didn't give you any happy, evil, or bitter thoughts. There was only your Buddha mind, right? So this is when we are born. Where there are no thoughts, there's no language, it's just this. Afterward, when your intelligence appeared, you probably should have put that in quotes. Afterwards, when your intelligence appeared, you saw and heard other people saying and doing all kinds of things, bad things, good things. And you learned those habits and you made them yours. By the time you reach adulthood, deep-seated habits formed in this way of your own manufacture had emerged. Now, cherishing yourself and your own ideas, you have turned your Buddha mind into the path of demonic spirits. If you realize fully the meaning of what I've just said, and do not lose your temper or think you must have this or must have that, or decide you don't like this or you know, are feelings of bitterness or pity or whatever. If you don't have any of those, he said, and you live in your unborn Buddha mind, you will be a living Buddha. This is what I tell everyone, he says. I do it because when I was a young boy, I tried very hard to attain Buddhahood, the Buddha mind by myself. In the course of my practice, I sought help from all kinds of Buddhist teachers. I had interviews with them, questioned them about my various doubts and uncertainties, but nobody could give me any help. So I went practicing very hard on my own. I did Zazen, which is Zen meditation. I went and lived in mountains. I disciplined myself as severely as I possibly could, but none of it helped a bit. I didn't get any closer to understanding the Buddha mind. It's funny, the reason is, it's very much like the life of the Buddha. Right. The Buddha we know, after leaving home, spent 6 years seeking out all kinds of teachers. Finally, out of frustration, he just devoted himself to kind of ascetic practices by himself, all of this. Finally, when I was 26 years old, it suddenly came to me, and I arrived at my realization. I've been telling others about the unborn Buddha mind ever since. And then he says, I'm sure there's no one else who can teach these things as thoroughly as I do. Now, supposedly he really believed that. I mean, that was based on his own experience of just, going around and meeting all kinds of teachers. He really that was sort of his rejection of everything, because he felt there was lots, you know, that basically people were primarily teaching simply what they had heard or what they had read. but he had not encountered anyone of true experience. And because in his experience obviously led him to the understanding, oh, this is so simple. Mm. This is so simple. Everyone has this Buddha mind, and everyone, it can be shown clearly to them. So you see, he uses these examples of the things that are happening right now. The dog barking, the crow cawing, very simple examples of a bunch of people moving around together, all kinds of things that anybody would know, or the simple example of, rather than talking about self and all that, he talks about, you know, your neighbor, and they say this to you, and they say that to you. So you can clearly see, oh, yeah, it's so simple. Yeah, this is what I do. I trade in this marvelous illuminative wisdom, and I just become this petty little creature full of indignation and anger and hurt and resentment or fear, right? You can gather from what I've told you that my practice lasted many long years, and I came to realize my Buddha mind only after great hardship. But you can grasp your Buddha mind very easily, right where you sit, without that long punishing practice. That shows that the relation that links you to Buddhahood is stronger than mine was. You're all very fortunate indeed. Ever since I realized the wonderful working of the Buddha mind, I've been going around telling people about it. Many of them have become convinced of it too. Of course, it's not something that I learned from a Buddhist teacher. I discovered it on my own. And since I did, each time I tell others about it, these meetings, my words come from personal knowledge and experience. Having heard about it only once or twice probably will not be enough. So you should listen as many times as you need to. If you have any questions, ask them and I'll answer them for you. And then we'll just, oh, this is that, I love the blood one. Basically in this text there are two collections of these talks. Again, he gave these many long retreats that I said thousands of people would come. The town would be full. People would be sleeping everywhere. Part of the book is these two various series of talks, and then the second part is a dialogue. A layman asked Bankei, every time I clear a thought from my mind, another appears. Can anybody relate to that? Okay. Every time I clear a thought from my mind, another appears right away. Thoughts keep appearing like that without end. What can I do about them? Is this a question that everybody here can relate to? Yeah. So what can I do about them? Bankei replied, clearing thoughts from the mind as they arise is like washing away blood with blood. You may succeed in washing away the original blood, but you're still polluted by the blood you washed it in. No matter how long you keep washing, the blood stains never disappear. Have you noticed that? No matter what technique you utilize to push away, get rid of, stop, change, transform, provide antidotes to your thoughts, no sooner are you done than what happens? Another one pops up. Another one pops up. And not only that, a lot of the time, provide antidotes and do various kinds of manipulations with our thoughts, it only what? Increases their intensity. Okay. No matter how long you keep washing, the bloodstains never disappear. Since you don't know that your mind is originally unborn and undying and free of illusion, you think your thoughts really exist. That is why the practice that we have been doing of watching the mind, watching thoughts, right? Just watching them, looking right at them. What is a thought? Where do they come from? Where do they go? How long do they last? What are they made of? Right? It's so important. Why? Because from the point of view of thoughts, they appear what to us? Real. We think they're real. And because we think they're real, and because we identify with whatever they are saying, we are therefore led around by them, aren't we? Right? As was said, somebody referred to the Wizard of Oz. When Dorothy and the Scarecrow and the Lion and the Tin Man and even little Toto, when they thought that that wizard, that big wizard, remember him? That big face, the lights and the smoke. When they thought that wizard was real, they were what? Scared. And when he told them to go kill the Wicked Witch of the North? West, forgive me. It's been a little while. When he told them, go kill the Wicked Witch of the West, he just trembled out and did it. Because why? Because they thought he was what? The all-powerful Oz. Right? Because we think our thoughts are real, we heed everything they say. Right? They tell us to get angry. What do? We get angry. They tell us there's something to be scared of. We get scared of, even if there's nothing around. If some imagined future something could happen, we'll immediately get scared. Right? You know? It'll tell us, it'll remind us of something that happened 15 years ago, somebody did something to somebody, and we'll immediately get what? Angry. Just like that. Well, you know. And that's just for starters. Endlessly. It puts up this and puts up that, and endlessly out of our illusion, because we think they're real, solid, real bits of information, we what? We just follow them around, and we have all these kinds of emotional experiences, all of which is what? Self-manufactured. None of it is real in any way. So because of that, we endlessly transmigrate through this endless up and down, back and forth, emotional mobility, happy, sad, right? Endlessly. It doesn't stop. You have to realize that your thoughts are ephemeral and unreal. Again, unreal not that they don't appear, unreal and there's nothing of any solidity there. They're not real in any real way. The same way we've learned that our self, the self and the mind, why they may appear and there may be a sense of, when they're looked at, we see there's nothing there of any concreteness. You have to realize your thoughts are ephemeral and unreal, and without either clutching at them or rejecting them, just let them come and go by themselves. Have we heard this before? We heard this in 8th century Tibet, didn't we? Right? This is what the noble master Padmasambhava said to the old lady. Right? This is what the 13th century master who wrote Naturally Liberating Whatever Appears Before One, that's what he said. And here's Bankei in Japan. He didn't even speak Tibetan. He didn't speak Tibetan. Right? In Japanese. Right? Totally different language. Totally different thoughts. Saying the same thing. you have to realize your thoughts are ephemeral. How do you realize it? By investigating them. You will never know this if you do not investigate them. Right? Is that clear? That is why we investigate. That is why we look into our thoughts, our minds, ourself. Is that clear? So we know what they really are. Right? There was no such thing as the Wizard of Oz, was there? What was there? What was there? A little old man. Right, as confused as everybody else. Right. Lost. He was lost too. Right. Immediately, Dorothy, Toto, the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, the Cowardly Lion, immediately, when that cloth was taken away and they saw in truth what was there, all their fear of the wizard immediately disappeared, right? They didn't have to work at it. They didn't say, oh, this is going to take some time. It's going to take some time here. I'm not sure. Well, you know, it's like, you know, when you see it, you get it. Well, maybe there really is a wizard up there, you know what I mean? We're just, you know, because we go, what? It can't be this simple, right? You know, that's not real, and then when I look behind it, there's just this little old guy, you know, was just pushing the levers. That's all that's going on. There's nothing to be scared of here. Right, Andrew? There's nothing to protect here. What am I doing? That's a moment of realization, of clarity. You either get it or you don't get it. If you don't get it, what do? You keep looking. Well, you're sorry. But you keep looking until you get it. And if you get it, and 30 minutes later you forget it, what do? You look again. And so then you get, oh. All right. Because you always see the same thing. There is no wizard. There's nothing there. And that is as true in 8th century Tibet as 14th century Japan as 21st century America. Nothing has changed. This is the peerless wisdom about how things really are that has transmitted to us. It is the most precious thing in this world. We can have all the gold and all the money. We can be a multi-billionaire. But if we don't have this understanding, we will still suffer. We will still be deluded. We will still live in separation. Okay. So we are deeply fortunate that our life has brought us to be exposed to these teachings. These teachings that very simply and directly point out the truth of existence, the way things really are. Is that clear? And that's it. And once we understand that, no matter where we are, whatever our life situation is, whatever is happening, it does not matter. You know, because we now have the capability, moment to moment, of liberating every moment and living in freedom. You have to realize that your thoughts are ephemeral and unreal, and without either clutching at them or rejecting them, just let them come and go of themselves. They're like images reflected in a mirror. We've heard that one. A mirror is clear and bright and reflects whatever is placed before it, but the image does not remain in the mirror. The Buddha mind is 10,000 times brighter than any mirror and is marvelously illuminative besides. All thoughts vanish tracelessly into its light. Right? When you look directly at a thought, what happens? It disappears. That's it. All thoughts vanish in its light. It is that simple. All thoughts vanish tracelessly into its light, the light of awareness. Are there any questions? No. Good. So these are just a brief sharing of these teachings from the Japanese Zen master Bankei, 1622-1693. B-A-N-K-E-I. The book is called The Unborn, The Life and Teachings of Zen Master Bankei. So good.